everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week...
He sort of sidled over to me one day and said, "Why don't you write anything good?" And I said, "What do you mean, why don't I write anything good?" He said, "Why don't you write anything that me and my friends want to read?"
I mean, there are a lot of materials that look interesting at the moment, graphene being one of them, sort of wonder material in the same kind of category of silicon, and that has amazing properties.
And can we have a bit of Buffy voice?
Oh, wow, that was a long time ago. I mean, she was probably something like this.
That's all coming up on today's Read On.
On today's show, we're listening back to some of our favourite interviews from last year. So later on, we'll be hearing from Neil Gaiman. Red will be talking to narrator Lawrence Bouvard. And up first...
I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Miodovnik, Professor of Material Science at UCL and a co-founder of the Institute of Making, which is dedicated to improving our understanding of the elements and compounds we've used to build our modern world. His regular appearances on TV and radio have helped make him one of the best-known science communicators in the country. And his prize-winning book, Stuff Matters, is a collection of strange stories of the marvellous materials that shape our man-made world, such as paper, cement, plastics and stainless steel. Thank you for joining us, Mark.
It's a pleasure, thank you.
And for those who haven't read Stuff Matters, it starts off by telling us how a violent incident when you were a schoolboy sparked your interest in material science.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I got stabbed as a teenager on a station, Hammersmith Station in London. At the time, it was obviously stupid of me to get myself into that situation, but it had an upside, I think, in the end. But I know only too well how easy it is to get stabbed, and London is still full of people who get stabbed, so nothing's changed in that sense.
But many people sitting in that police station, rather than looking at the sharp staples pushed through the incident report that the police had made, wouldn't think, "Oh, why does that stainless steel have the power to cut through paper? Why did the razor blade that was brandished at you cut through several layers of clothing? And how can I expand my understanding of it?"
I think as a teenager, you are full of questions, aren't you? And I suppose I didn't really want to think about my actions. It probably was just about distraction, wasn't it? About the pain and the embarrassment that I'd caused. You know, I mean, you sort of feel embarrassed to be stabbed. I know that sounds weird, but I mean, you kind of think, "Oh man, I was so stupid to get into that situation." So maybe I was just sort of trying to kind of focus on other things, like how do you make a really sharp razor blade?
Well, clearly you made lemons into lemonade by building a career out of studying materials. Stuff Matters is a fascinating collection of insights into the materials that make up the world around us. Do you have a favourite material?
The truth is that I regard materials like you would regard your kids, you know, you don't really have favourites. They occasionally do something so amazing you just can't believe it. But in general, you just feel love for them all, don't you? And I think that's how I feel about materials.
And I suppose when you and I were children, silicon was the wonder material of the future, and certainly it's gone a long way to growing the world around us. Do you see a new silicon on the horizon? What's going to be the material, do you think, that's going to shape our world in the next couple of decades?
It's very hard to predict how things will pan out. I mean, there are a lot of materials that look interesting at the moment, graphene being one of them, sort of wonder material in the same kind of category of silicon, and that has amazing properties. As we look forward, probably the material change I feel most confident about is the fact that we will live in a more and more diverse and materially rich society, because it's that material richness that is an expression of our feelings about ourselves. So, I mean, the thesis of the book is really that this world around us that we've made is a reflection of us. It's an outward manifestation of who we are internally. So it starts off being about, you know, a desperate need for shelter and for security, buildings, architecture, tools. You know, it's about kind of taking control of a wild planet that will dispense with us at the age of 10, 20, 30 years old. You know, life expectancy was tiny. A storm would come in and it would just wipe everyone out. Or water would get infected and everyone would die. And so sort of getting control of water, getting control of, you know, shelter, food, this was the early materials. Like, this is why the ages of civilization were named after materials like copper, the Copper Age, you know, the Iron Age. You know, these are really important moments. But then as we've kind of come into the modern world, look around us and there's hundreds of materials. In each one of them is a sort of answer to a problem or a kind of expression of a dream that we have. So we want to fly. You know, that's been a long-held dream of humans. And aluminium came along and kind of made it happen for us, you know. And my prediction about the future is that that is going to continue because that is who we are. We make materials that express what we desire.
Yes, and I suppose we are also very good at designing specific solutions to specific problems. And as our understanding of the materials around us expands, we can bend those materials more and more to solve those problems.
Yeah, I mean, what's clear from the science is that what people might regard as magical properties or impossibilities, like being able to get to the moon or being able to communicate with someone instantly across the world, those things have turned out to be possible, and it's because we got the right materials. It's almost always a materials problem. These feats of impossibility that we've managed to achieve are materials, are made possible by materials. And there's a huge confidence, I suppose, in the scientific community, and I think it's all shared by society, that kind of anything is possible. We can go to Mars and live in Mars if we want to. If we want it enough, it's not impossible, you know?
And the flip side to that is that I love the fact that you are so keen on promoting the beauty of materials, the aesthetics of materials as well, that in the chapter paper, where you say paper will be much missed if it does disappear from our world, you also talk about its flexibility, its beauty, its use in origami and love letters, which we shouldn't lose sight of just because it can be superseded by electronic paper.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the aesthetic properties of materials are no less important than the functional properties, obviously, because we are sensual beings, you know, so we like to touch things, we like to smell them, we like to hear them, see them, all these things, and material properties are what give you that sensuality. And we've always had this kind of symbiotic relationship with our environment. We make our environment to kind of express ourselves and what we love and how we love and what we feel. So the silkiness of fabrics, or in fact, even just something as simple as these days we're very used to comfortable chairs, you know. Like, chairs of the past were stone and wood and then metal, and all of them very functional but incredibly uncomfortable.
Yes.
And then cushions evolved, you know, with horsehair and wool. But now we have these foam rubbers, which are incredibly comfortable. And they've kind of relieved the pressure on our bums collectively. And it's an amazing thing. But that ability to kind of, yeah, just to feel that the world is absorbing your weight and taking it. You know, that is a sensual feeling that's important.
Absolutely. And as a book lover, even though I find them impossible to read anymore in their physical paper form, I still keep my old collection of paperbacks and hardbacks just for being able to run my fingers down their spine, being able to smell that lovely sort of slightly decaying paper smell that fills libraries.
I do talk about the fact that actually if you wrap something up in paper, it turns it into something completely different. It's the simple act of just wrapping something in a thin layer of paper makes something from an object into a present. And that is so deceptively simple, but it is so important, you know. And then when you give it to someone and they open it, that opening becomes a new life for the object in their hands. And even if it's not a new object, it's new for them at that point. It's a kind of ceremonial and also very aesthetic moment because paper itself has this kind of, it's actually hard and strong enough to withstand, you know, the process of sending it to someone. But then it's soft and weak enough to be ripped open by a toddler. I mean, what an amazing material.
Was it important for you as somebody who writes love letters to the materials that you clearly adore and which give you a frisson of excitement, was it important for you to put that down on paper and create a book, hopefully living monument to that love?
I also love the feeling of books, and I think that it's a great privilege to be able to kind of get a book published. Because when it's on the screen or in your head, it's somehow very ephemeral. It feels like it's a dream, perhaps, some dreamlike. And then it becomes a book, and there's a reality, there's a kind of solidity and an authority that book form gives it. And it's thousands of years of us using that material for that purpose that you're tapping into. So, I mean, I suppose that's another point about materials, is that they have cultural and societal baggage that goes with them. That can be negative and it can be positive, and it's impossible to avoid. So that's why materials are so interesting, because they're sort of culturally, societally unique, as well as having physical, electrical, magnetic, sensual, aesthetic properties. And that's for each material: paper, steel, aluminium, foam rubber,
yes.
You know. It just goes on, you know, they all have them.
And I understand that you're working on another book at the moment.
It's about liquids. It's the prequel.
Right.
In a kind of simplistic sense of the word, like, you know, essentially liquids tend to come before solids. They often turn into solids, don't they? Materials, we think of materials as essentially solid things.
Yes.
I wanted to write about liquids because we have a very different relationship with them. They also have these kind of culturally interesting set of associations that we hold, but they are kind of alien as well. And I think it's the alienness of liquids juxtaposed to the kind of familiarity of solids that I want to kind of bring out. Acids, you know, acids burn you. Alkalis also burn you. It's like water drowns you. You know, mercury poisons you. They're dangerous, and not just that, but they never settle into a form. You can't leave them in a form. That is the nature of liquids. You might put them in a container, but then if you tip the container, they will change shape. And if the container's not stopped, they will pour onto the floor, and they will flow, and they'll get somewhere. They'll go somewhere. They don't care about us. You know, unlike materials where we can leave our cultural imprint on them or our physical, we can write a love letter on them, it will remain for a long time. Liquids refuse to cooperate. They are something completely different. So I'm trying to get at that. What is it about liquids that is so kind of slippery?
The shapeshifters of the scientific world,
yeah.
I suppose.
That, yeah.
And we're lucky enough to have Stuff Matters available as an R&IB talking book.
Stuff Matters. The strange stories of the marvellous materials that shape our man-made world. As I stood on a train, bleeding from what would later be classified as a 13-centimetre stab wound, I wondered what to do. It was May 1985, and I had just jumped onto a London tube train as the door closed, shutting out my attacker, but not before he had slashed my back. The wound stung like a very bad paper cut, and I had no idea how serious it was. But being a British schoolboy at the time, embarrassment overcame any sort of common sense. So, instead of getting help, I decided the best thing would be to sit down and go home. And so, bizarrely, that is what I did.
Now, we have a section on Read On Air where I like to ask authors for the books of their lives, typically three books that have influenced them in some way, typically something from childhood or adolescence that made you want to become a writer, a book that you would love to return to on a rainy day when you've got nothing else to do, and something that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend.
I think the book that got me most hooked as a kid was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I mean, it's also a dangerous book, really, I think, for anyone. I mean, because it's so funny. It's a science fiction book, but because it's funny, it somehow transcends the genre of science fiction. It's addictive. The problem is, if you if you try and kind of emulate it, you'll always fall short. And I think that's the problem with having favourite books sometimes, is that you think, oh, I'd like to do something as good as that. And then, of course, that is just the surefire way of not doing anything good at all. But it is a great book.
Ford handed the book to Arthur.
What is it? Asked Arthur.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's a sort of electronic book. It tells you everything you need to know about anything. That's its job. Arthur turned it nervously in his hands.
I like the cover, he said. Don't panic.
It's the first helpful or intelligible thing anybody's said to me all day. I'll show you how it works, said Ford. He snatched it from Arthur, who was still holding it as if it was a 2-week dead lark, and pulled it out of its cover. You press this button here, you see, and the screen lights up, giving you the index. A screen about 3 inches by 4 lit up, and characters began to flicker across the surface. You want to know about Vogon, so I enter that name, so. His fingers tapped some more keys, and there we are. The words Vogon Constructor Fleets flared in green across the screen. Ford pressed a large red button at the bottom of the screen, and words began to undulate across it. At the same time, the book began to speak the entry as well, in a still, quiet, measured voice. This is what the book said. Vogon Constructor Fleets. Here is what to do if you want to get a lift from a Vogon. Forget it. They are one of the most unpleasant races in the galaxy. Not actually evil, but bad-tempered, bureaucratic, officious, and callous. They wouldn't even lift a finger to save their own grandmothers from the ravenous bug-bladder beast of Traal without orders signed in triplicate, sent in, sent back, queried, lost, found, subjected to public inquiry, lost again, and finally buried in soft peat for 3 months and recycled as firelighters.
And then I think books that I kind of got into that took me more down the line of the craft of writing that I could understand, of Primo Levi's books, in particular The Periodic Table, which is actually, you know, another inspiration for Stuff Matters. But this one, I think, I felt like I could get the spirit of more. And Primo Levi's an amazing man, or was an amazing man, and an amazing writer. And then recently, I guess I'm going to plump for Umberto Eco. I think Umberto Eco is what I really, really love about his writing is that it is sort of makes you think very deeply, but at the same time it's a hugely entertaining sort of romp. So he can write both a fictional, you know, it's like a sort of fictional account of an intellectual thought experiment often, and it appeals to me a lot. You definitely can't go wrong. I mean, if I had a rainy day, I'd read Foucault's Pendulum again, definitely, by Umberto Eco.
Me too, funnily enough. That's exactly what I'd choose. Well, Professor Mark Miodovnik, thank you very much for sharing the books of your life with us and also for coming onto the show and being such a great guest.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
And Mark Miodovnik's book, Stuff Matters, is available as Talking Book 21932. Thanks again to Mark for introducing us to the fascinating world of material science.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Laurence Bouvard is a familiar voice to many of us. When I checked the RNIB library earlier, I found she'd narrated no fewer than 85 titles. And then there are all the commercial audiobooks that she's read too. Her versatility spans the genres, from children's to young adult fiction, through romance, crime, fantasy, and non-fiction. She's read them all. It's always a pleasure to hear her voice and to have her on the show. Laurence Bouvard, welcome to Read On Air.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
So, how did you become a talking books narrator? Because I believe that you're a Harvard graduate of, well, tell us.
So, yes, I did my degree at Harvard in linguistics, and I came to Britain on a gap year after I finished my undergrad degree. I was supposed to start my PhD right away. And I came to Britain on a gap year in order to go to drama school, thinking that I would get it out of my system. And at the end of my course, I got the female lead in a West End musical and never went home. I'm a French-American dual national, so I was able to stay here as a French national. And PhD is still on hold. Someday, I keep thinking I'm going to go and do it someday. But I've been in the UK acting industry ever since, and I'm very happy to be here.
And we're delighted to have you having read quite so many talking books. What led you to the RNIB Talking Book Studio?
Well, when I got pregnant, obviously visual work was a lot harder to come by. And I'd always enjoyed doing voice work, and I'd done quite a bit of it. And I'd heard from some of my friends that they were reading for the RNIB. And I very cheekily wrote off and said, "Oh, I hear that you're looking for American readers." I'd heard nothing of the sort. And they wrote back and said, "Okay, come in and audition." And so I did. And shortly after my daughter was born, I did my first book. And that was 18 years ago. And I've now done about 150, nearly 200 books for lots of different publishers.
Oh, my goodness. Can you remember what your first book was?
I can't remember, but I think it was a young adult thing. It may even have been the Buffy series. Well, I think it may have been that.
I must say, this is you have scored so many cool points with my two teenage daughters who are massive Buffy fans. And can we have a bit of Buffy voice?
Oh, wow. That was a long time ago. I mean, she was probably something like this. Like, "Oh my God, you're not really going to do that, are you? Oh, look, there's a ghost. Ha, sorry."
You're also the voice of What Katie Did Next and the Goosebumps series as well.
Yes, I love doing young adult books. I love the freshness of youth fiction. And it doesn't have, like, of course I enjoy the other genres and the crime thrillers, but when you're doing some of the crime thrillers, like I did a book recently, which was so frightening, it gave me nightmares. And doing the young adult books, there's just a freshness and an excitement and an openness to the world before all the bad things happen that I really like.
And also they play with genres, don't they? You don't, you know, if you have a crime thriller, it tends to have to fall within certain parameters, whereas actually, you know, the young adult fiction can mix genres quite happily, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've done all sorts of different types. I did The Pickle King, which was sort of a youth thriller, which was about, you know, a 12-year-old detective, which was really lovely. Yeah, and, you know, and sometimes they cover pretty heavy subjects, but it's still within this world that isn't quite the adult world yet, which is very refreshing.
And do you find one genre much easier to engage with and read than another? Do you have a favorite genre?
I think I really do like the young adult, but because I read everything that I'm given, as an audiobook reader, you don't choose. People who don't read books think, "Oh, it's great. I'll go be an audiobook reader and I can read Mary Poppins." It depends on what your voice is suited to. So one of the things I love about my job is I never know what I'm getting next. And since January of this year, I've done maybe 12, 14 titles. And they've ranged from young adult to a primal diet cookbook to the history of psychology to a murder mystery to a sci-fi fantasy book. So I don't know. I feel disloyal if I say I like one more than the other.
Okay. Have you ever had to turn a book down because you just didn't feel that it engaged you or you just didn't want to read it?
There was one book that I really, really wish I had turned down. The problem is timelines are very tight. So We're asked if we want to do a book before we even get the manuscript, before we see what it's about. And they're not published, most of them now. So I generally just say yes, but this one book came and I had several other books on it and I flipped through it and it seemed like it was a normal crime drama. It turned out to be the most disturbing piece of fiction I have ever read, to the point that myself, the engineer, and the producer were all scarred by it. And even many years later, we look at each other and go, do you remember that book? And they go, yes. It was horrifying. And I think, I don't know if there's any way around it because of the way the timelines go, but I do think now that I'm going to draw the line at really severe violence like that. Mm. Those are images I really don't think anybody needs in their head.
No, well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, every so often as a listener, I do have to put a talking book to one side just because it takes a direction that I don't feel comfortable with. And it's very odd when somebody's reading that to you rather than you reading it yourself, because you can't skip the passage.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I hadn't thought of that. And I think, too, it does show you the power of the spoken word. It's all very well for somebody to say, oh, it's just words, it's meaningless, it doesn't mean anything. But I think language is incredibly powerful. Mm. And a book like that really showed to me how careful you need to be in what images you portray and what you say, because it can be damaging.
Absolutely. Well, let's turn to Happy Affair. I did notice that you have read an awful lot of Mills and Boone.
Please don't judge me.
No, not at all. But I mean, the titles are great. I thought the billionaire's virgin mistress sounded fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I do find them quite a romp. And they're usually unintentionally funny. They're a particular genre and their particular style. And actually, with the rise of audiobooks and the rise of e-readers, but mainly audiobooks, the market has gone through the roof. Because if you're listening on your iPhone, nobody knows what you're listening to. Whereas with the old-fashioned one, with those lurid covers, you had to kind of hide the cover when you were sitting out in public. And I do think they're just a harmless romp. They're kind of like a Mars bar for the brain. The only time I get a little bit cross is when very often they're set in exotic locales, which is fantastic. But then the author will sometimes try and write some dialogue in the language of the place, and sometimes it goes badly wrong. So there was one I remember recording where it was supposed to be this Italian family, you know, this very wealthy Italian family that owned an island or castle or both. And the young man had made the woman pregnant, but by IVF, so it's okay. She was still a virgin. And he goes to see his father, and he says to his father, supposedly, I'm so very sorry. But the Italian that the author had written actually translated to, I am disgusting. And I just think in those books, you know, I know you're writing them quickly, authors, but you could do a bit more research.
Do you get stuck when it comes to technology? Don't worry. Help is at hand with RNIB's Technology Support Squad. We can give you advice over the phone or visit you at home to help you master your technology. Help is at hand, from setting up a mobile phone and getting the most out of it to using the accessibility features on your PC. Or maybe you need help with your Daisy talking book player. You can email technologysquad@rnib.org.uk and we'll get right back to you. Or call our helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. Get the most out of your technology with RNIB's Technology Support Squad.
Neil Gaiman is one of the biggest names in fantasy fiction. He's won international acclaim for his comic book series The Sandman and for novels such as American Gods and The Graveyard Book, and notched up numerous TV, film, and radio successes. Our reporter, Hannah Taus, caught up with Neil Gaiman at the Hay Festival and obtained this exclusive interview. Sit back and enjoy a fascinating insight into the world of a master storyteller.
Gods of the Vanir, like the sister and brother Freya and Frey, live in Asgard with the Aesir. History and religion and myth combine, and we wonder and we imagine and we guess like detectives, reconstructing the details of a long-forgotten crime.
Norse mythology, it's your latest book. How much of a challenge is it to take these kind of great classic epics and turn it into modern prose?
There's two answers, and they're both true, one of which is not much of a challenge at all, and the other is it was really, really difficult. But what was difficult was figuring out the voice that I needed to tell the stories in, or actually the voice that I was going to retell the stories in, because I'm taking stories from the prose Edda of Snorri and from the poetic Edda, I'm taking things that are poems, taking things that are very dry descriptions of what happened. And the task then becomes figuring out the voice. And it probably took me as long to work out the kind of voice I wanted to tell these stories in as it did to write them, which is in each case several years. Once I had the voice in my head, then it was a joy. I would write a story between projects. So every time I finished a screenplay or handed in a book or whatever, I would then write one of my... It was like having knitting. You know, I have aunts who keep knitting in their handbags at all times. And when nothing's going on, they take it out and they do some knitting. And Norse mythology was my knitting.
There are so many Norse stories we do not have, so much we do not know. All we have are some myths that have come to us in the form of folktales, in retellings, in poems, in prose. They were written down when Christianity had already displaced the worship of the Norse gods. And some of the stories we have came to us because people were concerned that if the stories were not preserved, some of the kennings, the usages of poets that referred to events in specific myths, would become meaningless. Freya's tears, for example, was a poetic way of saying gold.
And I loved the idea. I think one of the things that drove me was a weird kind of dualistic thing. I loved the idea of reaching somebody who was like I was, age 7, aged 8, aged 9, aged 10, who was waiting for these stories to enter their life but didn't know it yet. And I also wanted to reach adults, either who had encountered these stories as children but wanted to now read them again, or again, who had never really encountered them, and I wanted to build a cycle, build a pattern, take these stories and go, okay, I'm going to take you from creation through to Armageddon, through to Ragnarok, the end of everything, and take you just a little bit after that. And I'm not going to make stuff up in the strict sense. If something, I may embroider, I may tell a story, I may add corroborative detail, and I may go, okay, if I was telling you this story and it was 1200 years ago when we're sitting around a fire and we've all eaten, and now I'm going to tell you this story, I will. And I'm going to try and do it in terms that would probably all work for somebody in the 8th or 9th century. I'm not going to use modern analogies. Something is not going to be the size of a lorry or whatever. Getting that to work was an absolute delight and occasionally a frustration. But when I finished it, I got to step back and go, okay, I think I did something new and something fun with the myths and something nobody's quite done before. And the reaction and the response to it has been terrifyingly gratifying.
Do you have any connection with visual impairment or sight loss?
I don't, you know, apart from the fact that from my perspective, it's definitely, as I head into middle age, late middle age now, have to come to terms with a world in which everybody is writing things down smaller and smaller and fuzzier. I did a signing last night, and there was actually a point where somebody had written their name down, and I said, "Who am I signing it for?" And she said, "For me," and pointed to what she had written, and I was like, what does it say?
Do you have any difficulty at all with your publishers in trying to encourage them to do large print books or audio recordings?
Yeah, no, I've always said yes to everything. I mean, my position on doing stuff for the blind, for the visually impaired, has always been we say yes. And that's yes to allowing people to read the stories on tape in the old days. That's yes to making sure that people have access to the professional recordings wherever possible. That's yes to large print books and large print editions. And actually, interestingly, it was also yes to heading onto the Kindle back in 2007, where I remember being given a trial Kindle by Amazon and going, well, it's really ugly and everything about this is kind of clunky. But the fact that I can change the font size to something that is comfortable for me, and I know my dad can change the font size to something that is comfortable for him, this is going to be the killer app. It's going to be an app that is actually going to be driven by people. Normally apps get driven by the young, and on that one I went, no, this is going to be driven by the middle-aged and older who see it as freedom from the large print book selection, because anything can be a large print book now.
You've written both graphic novels, comics, and the more traditional book format. How difficult is it to switch between the two aspects, one where you don't need many words and one where everything has to be described?
Well, everything has to be described anyway. It's just whether or not you, as the person reading it, are reading my descriptions or not. I could be describing things for a reader to build a picture in her head, or I can be describing things for an artist to draw a picture for the reader. When I was writing Sandman as a monthly comic, I think there were probably about 2,500 words per issue in terms of what you would see in captions and word balloons. But each Sandman script was about 10,000 words long. So you were getting approximately, you know, 4 pages of description where I'm just saying, okay, page 17, panel 3, this is what we're looking at. And you're doing that for an artist.
Some of your heroes tend to be quite unexpected, or should I say unsuspecting. What is it that appeals to you about writing that sort of hero?
I think that one of the lovely things to do with protagonists is to start going, okay, what would it be like if it was me? Or not me, but necessarily what would it be like if it was a 9-year-old girl version of me? What would it be like if this happened to somebody I knew? And all of a sudden, you wind up with a different class of hero. You wind up with the kind of protagonists who actually do have to outthink their way, because they're definitely not going to be able to outpunch their way through a story.
It's a beautiful way of putting it. You're brought up in Britain, of course. Move to America. Which culture has the strongest influence on what you write?
I think the UK culture has the strongest influence on what I write. People ask me, you know, are you a British or an American writer? And I explain, for the purpose of their essays, I'm whatever you want. It doesn't matter. If you want to write an essay on me as an American writer, it's fine. I've won American awards and I've lived there for about 25 years. But the literature that formed me, which I think is weirdly the most important thing, is British. Even though, you know, P.L. Travers, who wrote the Mary Poppins books, was Australian. But there is something in terms of style. C.S. Lewis, off in Northern Ireland. But it's that style. It's P.G. Wodehouse. The people who shaped me when I was too young to realize they were shaping me, I think are probably the most important writers there.
And what about your children? How have they influenced what you write? I know you've got grown-up children, you've also got a young son. How has it shaped your books? And are they critical of them?
Well, I don't think that I would have been a children's writer as well if it wasn't for having kids, which had more to do with the desperate need to try and demonstrate to my children that I did actually have a proper job. And I remember when my son Mike, who's now 33, was about 12, he sort of sidled over to me one day and said, "Why don't you write anything good?" And I said, "What do you mean, why don't I write anything good?" He said, "Why don't you write anything that me and my friends want to read?" I said, "Well, what do you want to read?" And he said, "We read X-Men, you know, you write comics and they're all stupid." And I said, "Well, you know, stick around 3 or 4 years and I'll be cool." He said, "What are you going to write?" And I said, "Well, the same stuff, but honestly, in 3 or 4 years, I'll be cool." But there was a definite realization at that point that it was time to, for example, finish Coraline, which I had started years earlier for my kids, and I just sort of got swept away because there was so much to do. So I finished Coraline. And the Graveyard book, which I actually began in my head for Mike when he was like 2 years old, got finished when he was in his 20s. There's a level on which I don't think I would have been as enthusiastic a writer of children's books. It's not... People assume that if you are a successful writer of books for adults, as I was, that writing for children is something that will also come easily and naturally, and that you will be welcomed and that publishers will be keen on you doing. In actual fact, the expression on a children's publisher's face when they hear that somebody who writes books for adults has just decided to write a children's book and is sending it their way combines trepidation, fear, worry, and a kind of almost PTSD thing of, oh my God, it's starting again, which is something I didn't learn until after Coraline had come out and been published, and it was sort of confided in me by my children's publisher that they were very worried when they heard that you know, adult author is sending them a book because it's how to be polite and turn down books without offending adult authors is probably some of the trick. So I don't know that I would have, you know, necessarily faced those shoals without having kids and without having the desire to write something that made them think that I'd done something real.
Coraline also explored for animals. She found a hedgehog and a snake skin, but no snake, and a rock that looked just like a frog, and a toad that looked just like a rock. There was also a haughty black cat who would sit on walls and tree stumps and watch her, but would slip away if ever she went over to try to play with it. That was how she spent her first 2 weeks at the house, exploring the garden and the grounds.
You've collaborated with some incredible people over the years. Who else is on your wish list, living or dead?
Oh, living or dead. I'm so lucky because the people I have collaborated with have been the kind of people who I got to not only collaborate with, but I got to learn from. Working with Terry Pratchett on Good Omens was like the ultimate masterclass in novel writing. I've compared it in the past to Michelangelo calling you up and saying, "Hey, do you want to come over and paint a ceiling with me?" It's like, well, yes, actually, I do, and I will learn so much. In terms of people who I'd like to collaborate with, all of my living authors who I love are people who I love to read and have no desire to collaborate with because I want to see what they're going to do. There's definitely a little part of me that wants to collaborate, not with Stephen Sondheim now, but who would love, I would love to have been an adult in the early 70s and to have worked on a musical of some kind with Stephen Sondheim. That would be absolutely, you know, I can imagine that happening, and I would love to have done that. In terms of everything and everybody out there, it would be fascinating to have got to work with P.G. Wodehouse. It would be fascinating to have worked with W.S. Gilbert. But mostly, even when I start putting these things together in my head, what I start thinking is, but I want to see what you do. You know, would I like to have written with Dickens? No, I like reading Dickens. Writing like Dickens or with Dickens would be fun, but reading Dickens is always much more fun.
So if you had to choose one book from childhood that made you desperate to become a writer, what would it be?
The Narnia series, seven Narnia books, and if I had to get it down to one, it would probably be The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I think what was so important to me was it was the first time I'd really got a sense that there was a writer there and who the writer was. The way C.S. Lewis would put things in brackets, these little parenthetical asides to the reader, that would make you go, oh, somebody is telling me this story, and I think I would probably like the person who is telling me this story. And that point where you're reading the Narnia books, and I got all seven. I originally had read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and then got all of the books for my seventh birthday in a boxed set, and just remember lying on my bed and reading them, and read them over and over for probably the next 3 or 4 years, reading other books too, because there weren't an infinite number of Narnia books, and you can only read all seven books a certain number of times, and also going, you know, and some of the books are not as good as the others. And they've stuck with me. I've read them to my children. So I've now read all of the Narnia books aloud twice, and I'm sure that when Ash turns 6 or 7 or 8, I will read them all to him again. I don't know that I would have been a writer without them, or I don't know that I would have been the writer that I became without them.
There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. His parents called him Eustace Clarence, and masters called him Scrub. I can't tell you how his friends spoke to him, for he had none. He didn't call his father and mother, but Harold and Alberta. They were very up-to-date and advanced people. They were vegetarians, non-smokers, and teetotalers, and wore a special kind of underclothes. In their house, there was very little furniture, very few clothes on the beds, and the windows were always open. Eustace Clarence liked animals, especially beetles, if they were dead and pinned on a card. He liked books, if they were books of information, and had pictures of grain elevators or of fat foreign children doing exercises in model schools.
If you had a book to curl up with on a rainy day, reread, something that's like comfort food for you, which one would that be?
My comfort reading is very strange because I do have my comfort reading book, and it tends to change with the decades. But the last decade, it's definitely been Henry Mayhew's 1850s study of a set of interviews and descriptions, London Labour and the London Poor. And it sounds dry as dust and probably rather dull. And indeed, every now and again, when he goes off into his analyses of how many oysters, chickens and cabbages were probably sold in London the previous year or whatever, it is rather dull. But mostly it's interviews, and he's going out, I'm assuming, with some kind of stenographer, and or occasionally it's himself in a notebook, probably transcribing afterwards. And he's talking to people and asking them about their lives and their stories, and whether it's boys selling flypaper or street magicians or street singers or costermongers or mudlarks, the children who hang around in the mud underneath the bridge, and the passers-by throw pennies into the mud and the kids dive down and bring it up. And then they also talk about finding bits of coal that have fallen off ships and bringing them in, and lumps of fat, and that's how they're making their living. And it turns into this thing that's like a huge, plotless Charles Dickens novel that just goes on forever in all directions. And it becomes my comfort reading, because I read it and start to go, okay, what would it have been to live in that city 160 years ago?
Is it the social history aspect of it that appeals to you, or personal stories?
Personal stories. The social history you get anyway. You know, there's that line, when I was growing up, the personal is political. And the personal is political. You can't divorce the people from the politics. But what absolutely fascinates me is you're not talking general lives, you're talking specific lives, and you get a sense with each thing, some of which are just inconceivable. You know, on Hammersmith Bridge, there was a man who set up a thing called a happy family, and the happy family was a bunch of animals who should not have been in the same big glass cage, in a big glass cage, and you could come past and look at these, you know, here are the mice and the eagles and the cats and the dogs and the monkey and the pigeons, and all of these things are living happily. And he explains how he trains them and how he got this idea and how it happened and how much money he used to get from displaying them, but now everybody's sort of a bit bored of the thing, and you're going, this is a life which is like every other life, completely unlike any other life.
The street sellers are to be seen in the greatest numbers at the London street markets on a Saturday night. Here, and in the shops immediately adjoining, the working classes generally purchase their Sunday's dinner. And after pay time on Saturday night, or early on Sunday morning, the crowd in the New Cut, and the Brill in particular, is almost impassable. Indeed, the scene in these parts has more of the character of a fair than a market. There are hundreds of stalls, and every stall has its one or two lights. Either it is illuminated by the intense white light of the new self-generating gas lamp, or else it is brightened up by the red smoky flame of the old-fashioned grease lamp. One man shows off his yellow haddock with a candle stuck in a bundle of firewood. His neighbour makes a candlestick of a huge turnip, and the tallow gutters over its sides. While the boy shouting, "Eight a penny, stunning pears!" has rolled his dip in a thick coat of brown paper that flares away with the candle. Some stalls are crimson with the fire shining through the holes beneath the baked chestnut stove. Others have handsome octahedral lamps, while a few have a candle shining through a sieve. These, with the sparkling ground-glass globes of the tea-dealers' shops, and the butchers' gaslights streaming and fluttering in the wind like flags of flame, pour forth such a flood of light that at a distance the atmosphere immediately above the spot is as lurid as if the street were on fire.
And is there a book that you'd like to recommend for our audience that you've read recently?
You know, I always hesitate to recommend books to audiences because my taste is always my taste. But I will recommend a book which actually was a bestseller and has even been adapted into a TV series, which is, I think, still my favorite book of the last little bit over a decade, which is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. It really feels like Jane Austen's lost fantasy epic. It's a beautiful, very human, very loving study of two rather awkward people who managed to bring back magic to England. And I recommend it because I think it's a wonderful book, even for people who are certain that they don't like that kind of thing.
Some years ago, there was in the city of York a society of magicians. They met upon the third Wednesday of every month and read each other long, dull papers upon the history of English magic. They were gentlemen magicians, which is to say they had never harmed anyone by magic, nor ever done anyone the slightest good. In fact, to own the truth, not one of these magicians had ever cast the smallest spell, nor by magic caused one leaf to tremble upon a tree, made one mote of dust to alter its course, or changed a single hair upon anyone's head. But, with this one minor reservation, they enjoyed a reputation as some of the wisest and most magical gentlemen in Yorkshire.
My thanks to Hannah and to Neil Gaiman. You can find all of the books of his life, as well as a wide selection of the books that he's written, in the RNIB library. And don't forget, if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Alas, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. You can do so too by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.